Welcome to Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and today we're going to be talking about evolving cultural norms and their effects on medical educators. I think many of us intuitively understand the vulnerabilities of trainees. They work extremely hard and have little control over their schedules. Their futures are uncertain. And many of them are navigating these uncertainties while starting families, managing educational debt, and worrying that the future of medicine is bleak. Less discussed, though, is the vulnerability of medical educators. I think this vulnerability has arisen from several factors. Many of them come from outside medicine. There's an intense focus in society at large on wellness and self-care. We're endlessly encouraged to set boundaries, eliminate toxic relationships, and insist on our own well-being. Meanwhile, there's growing intolerance in U.S. educational environments of anything not considered a quote-unquote safe space. And because social media have inverted many power structures, the people feeling most wronged in any given cohort may not be the most representative of the group, but they often have the loudest voice. As these factors converge, it's become more difficult for educators to set and maintain standards of excellence because they fear being accused of trainee mistreatment, but they also fear talking about it. In my reporting, I heard so many stories from educators describing how hard it's become to enforce educational norms that could be construed as threats to well-being. And since the essays have been published, I've actually heard from many more. But almost no one wants to go on the record and talk about it, and I totally understand why. People fear losing their jobs, being canceled, seeming old and out of touch, or being perceived as uncaring about trainees. So I wasn't surprised that it was exceedingly difficult to find people willing to come on the podcast and speak candidly about these tensions. But about a month ago, I was forwarded an email chain from a listserv for deans of medical education discussing some of these challenges, and I was struck by the courage and candor of our guest today, Dr. Amy Holthauser. Amy's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Louisville, and she spent over two decades in educational leadership roles, including as a senior associate dean for undergraduate medical education. And when I reached out to her, expecting a hard no, Amy said she wasn't afraid to publicly voice her concerns. Though we'll be talking today about how these challenges play out among medical students, my sense, having spoken to many physicians who are training residents and fellows, is that a lot of this growing cultural intolerance of discomfort is affecting postgraduate medical education as well. So since I found Amy on the listserv, I started out by asking her a little bit about the concerns being raised on the email chain and about some of these tensions between education and well-being.
I think some of the interesting things to me about when people talk about well-being and talk about why it's important, they really choose to frame it as if people running medical schools and medical institutions don't already want to do what's right. The first thing is to realize that the people who are running your medical schools and who are running your residency programs and who are running your institutions of care, by and large, are the same people who want to do what's right always, including with their trainees. And the feeling that trainees have that nobody cares about them and nobody cares about their well-being is so the opposite of the truth. It feels a lot like when you are coping with teenagers as a parent and you can't seem to bridge that gap where they understand that you deeply care about them. And this is how you're showing your caring. Is making sure that they are prepared, that they have what they need, and that you are entrusting them and empowering them to grow through uncomfortable times and to adapt to what is surely a never-ending list of life's difficulties. I think that's the first core misfire or mistaken assumption underlying almost all of these conversations. the things that go on the listserv are talking about the concerns folks have are feeling that students are not going to be prepared for the rigors of caring for patients, balancing that with the other things that are important in their life as they grow and as they enter attendinghood. I mean, one of the really true things that attendings, or just we call them regular doctors, right, out in the community, talk about is how working full time as a doctor is so much harder, actually, than residency, fellowship, medical school. And when you were in your training, you thought that was the hard part. You thought once you got done, life would be easier. And if all that happened when you got done was that you went to non-residency hours and you got a bigger paycheck, that would maybe be true. But it also is very specialty dependent. It's very dependent on the paycheck that you want and the life you set up for yourself. It's very dependent on your family structure, on your role in the family. And, you know, speaking for myself, I'm a woman in medicine. I'm a full professor. I did a dual residency in internal medicine and pediatrics, and then ran a medical school for a long time. The hardest thing I've ever done is still have two small children back to back. That's way harder than any of those things. The second hardest thing was trying to parent those children through COVID, you know, while my husband had cancer and I was running a medical school from my basement. So there's things that happen, and when you're coping with and trying to lovingly lead and coach medical trainees at any stage, and they are telling you that their perception is what you're doing to them by educating them and creating a structure for their education is harmful and is hurtful. It's really in direct opposition with what most doctors' actual lived experiences, which is that medical school residency and fellowship, those aren't the hardest parts of your life. That's where I was coming from on my listserv post, was to say, we are so anxious as medical educators to make sure that our children are happy that we've forgotten that our main goal here is not to make them happy. Our main goal is to provide them with an education, mentorship, coaching, and guidance.
Okay, first, I'm really sorry about your husband, and I hope he's okay.
He's okay. Thank you.
So I want to just try to get a little more specific in terms of the complaints that are surfacing among the students and trainees. The email chain that I was forwarded was about requests for wellness days, which actually I have heard globally is something that, you know, across the nation, that's coming up all the time. I'm wondering, what is it that the students are asking for that feels antithetical to their learning?
There's things that may feel antithetical to their learning or to a, there's that, that's one concern. I think the other concern, though, is we don't have any evidence that these interventions we're putting into place make any difference in the wellness scores of our students or the burnout scores. And the gains, if you have any in student satisfaction, are very minimal, typically last for the year, for that year of students that asked for that benefit. And then since it's taken kind of for granted by the next year that never had it a different way before, they have new demands. And so what you experience when you're in these jobs for a while of medical school leadership is you experience a continual erosion of anything that was recognizable or mapped to the understanding of the expectations for what life's going to be like in residency, what patient loads are going to be like in residency, how are you going to balance your wake-sleep cycle or your need to go to doctor's appointments or things like that once you're an attending. I think that wellness days are one of a whole host of things that students might ask about or for. And on its face, it's not necessarily a problem. The question is, the wellness days are in addition to what? Because 3 years ago, maybe, or in our case, 10 years ago, students asked to have the day prior to their shelf exam off for clerkships, and they got it. And then students asked that the day before that be a half day, and they got it. And then students asked, what's really the benefit of us having any overnight call on these clerkships? And so students went from having overnight calls on OB internal medicine, surgery, pediatrics, psychiatry, to only having one or two overnight calls their entire medical student career in the surgery clerkship, and that still being viewed as a detriment to their education and to them personally, rather than something that would maybe be helpful to walk through before you have to do it for the first time when patients are actually depending on you. And so I think it's not that there's any single request or any single wish list item for students or for wellness that's in and by itself triggering concern. I think it's that there is an awful lot of creep going on. And if you look at the differences from 10 years ago to now, or 5 years ago to now, they are pretty stark. And we're also overlooking some pretty good older studies that say, hey, you know what? The more patients you take care of while you're a clerkship student, the better you actually do on measures of medical knowledge. Because the assumption from the student standpoint is, I'll do better on these clerkship exams if I can do more questions. Which, yeah, they probably will. And patients will also help. Because all of us that were doctors, that were took shelf exams or took boards, were like, oh, I had a patient with that.
I asked Amy what happens if anyone on the listserv points out the downsides of this creep. And she noted that someone would invariably quote studies about the pervasiveness of burnout.
You can quote lots of different studies. You can find a study that almost fits kind of any argument. The study you can't find is, do any of these things we have put into place make our students more well, make them happier, make them more academically successful? Do any of them help their learning? You can't find a study like that. But what I can tell you is that the experience of the deans kind of collectively, and particularly since COVID, is no. As we've put more study days into the clerkship rotations, have students done better on their measures of medical knowledge? No. In fact, since COVID, we've had an increased failure rate on boards, on shelf exams, in classes in general. And it feels like the suggestions that are being made and the requests that are being made and the things that are being put into place, it feels like we're doing cognitive behavioral therapy for a broken leg. It might fix something, but it's not fixing the problem.
What cognitive behavioral therapy for a broken leg. I love that. What is the problem?
You know, you could ask at different deans, and I'm sure you'd get different answers. The problem that I see is, first and foremost, there's a near total loss in the just pure joy of learning. And what I mean is, I yesterday was on the pediatric wards, and I had a baby admitted for hyperbilirubinemia. Pretty standard diagnosis, nothing exciting. But I got so excited because I actually think this baby might have G6PD deficiency, and that his hemolytic disease was triggered not by ABO mismatch, which is like standard problem, but by the med that his mom was taking for her lupus. And so you get these like crazy connections and you're like, oh my gosh, I know things and I am an expert. And I just solved a problem that really matters to somebody. Or I'm gonna know this, and it's just cool to know it, you know? And I remember having that feeling when I was a medical student. It's what I loved. It's why I ended up being a medical teacher, I'm sure. I always said, like, what good is it being able to feel a liver unless you can show a medical student, right? That pure love of learning has been lost. And now it's just, what's the minimum that I have to do to meet some kind of external criteria so that I can match into whatever my chosen field is? And also, there's not enough choosing your chosen field based on something that you actually love. Like, I work full-time as a clinician now after only having been a clinician. I was 20% clinical during my whole time that I was in medical education. So not very much, right? And if you look at burnout studies and things like that, you would have expected that I would switch to all clinical and be like, oh man, this sucks. Like, there's all this, you know, paperwork. There's all this. I'm happy as a clam. I get to go in. I'm joking with these babies and these parents. I get to solve problems. I'm working more hours. It's so much easier. It's so much easier. And it's so satisfying. And so for me, like, I have a little bit more trouble, frankly, with my wellness on my days off. I'm like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, I like to be busy. I like to solve problems. Huh. Let me look at this people in my house. maybe they're the problem. Maybe I need to solve, you know, some of them. Maybe this isn't quite clean enough, you know. So what I'm describing, though, and I know I'm being silly about it, is there's a really near perfect match between what I like to do and what I get to wake up and do every day as a human being. And to me, that means it doesn't feel like work. And so I don't worry about burnout because it feels good to me to be at work and not in a sick, like, workaholic way. It just feels like, oh, this is my life's purpose and this is what I'm meant to be doing. And I don't see that happening a lot with a lot of our graduates, which means, yeah, it would suck. It would feel terrible if you stayed in school for 4 years and then in residency for 4 years or 6 years. And every single day it felt like you were just waiting for the enjoyable part to start. That's the problem. That's the broken leg.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned sort of even in passing, which is the anxiety among a lot of educators, and an anxiety that relates to the imperative to keep students and trainees happy. And I want to try to break down this anxiety because I think we should just point out that, you know, I interviewed a lot of people for these essays. Most people would only speak to me on the condition of anonymity. I have been asking people all over the place to come onto the podcast and talk about this aspect of education. And basically everyone says, no, you're the first person who said, like, I'm going to come on and I'm going to say what I think. So clearly there's both a pervasive anxiety as well as like a collective observation. And I want to understand what that anxiety is all about.
Truthfully, I think, again, the experience that it feels the most like is the experience of being a parent. It is the anxiety about having to have a tough conversation, not only with one-on-one with one person, but with a whole class of students, for example, or a whole cadre of students, and say, I understand that this is what you're asking for. I understand that this is how you think it's going to help you. My observation is, we've done this, 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 and this that are all similar in vain, and it hasn't helped. In fact, our outcomes are worse. And my concern is if we do this, then we're going to continue down the same path. And your path actually leads to this type of activity in which you're going to have to engage. And if I don't give you more practice before you get there, it's going to be quite painful. And I won't have done my job to prepare you. And so I care about you and I lovingly decline to do it. So I think there's a few things, right? Because I think the first thing is, it feels weird for grown-up people to tell people that they love each other in the general sense in the workplace and in the school place. But it's very real. It's very genuine, especially in medical education. The love is there. And so I think that's one thing. You asked me, like, what are my concrete suggestions? I think, you know, bring the love back. Not to sound like Barry White or somebody, but we got to start telling our students we love them. We got to start doing it in the way that, and show it, you know, show up for them. Have an open door policy, listen to them. And then we've got to not let our own anxiety about, well, gosh, my boss is going to hear from the provost if an angry student writes an email. What if an angry student writes an email to the LCME? What if I get sued by a student? These are all things that have happened, you know, either to me or to people that I'm close to in medical education. What if I get personally sued? What if I get death threats from an ex-student that's been dismissed for unprofessional behavior? So these are all, none of these are wild stories. If you ask people, they know people or they've personally been through it. And when you come from a place of love and all of the work that you do with students, and then that happens to you, it feels very much like when you love your patients or when you love your kids, but your kid does something terrible or your patient says or does something terrible to you, assaults you when you're just trying to help them, you know, which again has happened to most of us at some point in our career. Then I think the other kind of real, more structural reasons why people are afraid, everyone's afraid, even on that listserv, of posting anything about some of the true problems that they have at their school. Or, like, for example, everyone kind of across the nation had a disastrous step 1 year in, let's see, what year was it? 2021? 2021, I think, which was the year that step one went pass fail. So 21 or 21, 2020, anyway. I can't remember now. That tells you how much I've moved on. And nobody was talking about it. Nobody was sharing from their school, like, it's a bloodbath over here. How are you all doing? I personally only had a couple people I felt comfortable enough to reach out to their school and be like, we're dying. So they could be like, oh my God, girl, I'm dying too.
The bloodbath Amy's referring to is that in 2022, the year step one became pass-fail, there was a marked decrease in the pass rates, a decrease that was obviously upsetting to students and those who educate them.
What has happened? It's because you feel like you have to protect the reputation of your school. You have to protect the reputation of your boss. You don't want LCME to get wind of it because the LCME process is capricious. It is not even-handed. It is highly dependent on who your reviewer is and what they've heard about you or what their biases are. And it grows in complexity and in unwritten rules every year in a way that is just nearly impossible to grapple with. That takes teams of people years to ensure that the school's accreditation packet is up to snuff and so the school will, you know, pass accreditation. And every school gets at least some citations. There's no way to pass without at least some citations. So it's a process that's extremely costly in terms of money, in terms of people's time. And one of the things that's really a linchpin of the LCME process is truly student satisfaction surveys. Students run their own surveys. They ask the questions on the surveys that they want to. Yes, schools do pick the students that they think will be good and will work with the school to try to give a balanced approach. But if your student surveys are poor, and if they say terrible things about you as an administrator, you're likely to lose your job. And it doesn't matter what you've tried to do.
I didn't know that. I know that's happening in the residencies too, which is creating lots of challenges in terms of this, what you refer to as the erosion, because there's just a sense that there's no bottom in terms of the requests. And then if you don't meet the request, then the survey scores are going to be poor and you could lose your job. So there is fear of getting torpedoed on the surveys, it sounds like. It's fear of lawsuits or having emails sent to bosses about mistreatment. I want to ask you, I don't know how much of a social media presence you have, but one thing that I wanted to understand, but it's hard to quantify, is just the role that social media have played in creating, I think, you know, a perception or of grievance that is more ubiquitous than it might be than in days before we had social media, and some of these things could just be kept to one school. And many would argue, well, that's a good thing that, you know, social media have brought awareness to these problems that are, you know, globally occurring. But I think some people would also argue that it's made it so that people perceive things in their environments that might not necessarily be true. And I'm wondering what your experience of that is.
Well, again, you know, I'll remind you, I'm Gen X. Like, I love a sarcastic, caustic, cutting comment and meme. You know, I think they're funny. The problem is that mentally and emotionally, our windscreen is made up of our experiences and the experiences that we allow to have time in our day and allow to have our emotional investment in. And so when it moves beyond like being funny to being like, yeah, no, that's the truth. And that's the only truth. Then I think that we've our windscreen's just really dark. And what is the space and light and energy we're giving to the positive experiences we could have, the excellent professor that we had who was really there for us, the wonderful patient interaction that we had that was really positive, the funny interaction we had with our supervising resident or with our colleague on the team? Where's the joy and light that's being given to, oh my gosh, I finally understand congenital adrenal hyperplasia? I've probably studied that 5 times. I finally get it now. That's not symmetric. The joy, the energy that's being given that is not symmetric, whether that's social media or generational or something else. I think that's something that we each have to pay a lot of attention to on an individual basis. I do this with myself, with how do I change my thinking? How do I change my windscreen? How do I give oxygen to those things that are actually help me? I had a great surgery third year resident when I was on trauma, which was my first rotation as a clinical medical student. And it was exhausting, and it was 24-hour calls. It was Q2, 24-hour calls. And that's what I thought life was, because it was my first rotation. So you go to work on Monday, you came home Tuesday night, you went to work on Wednesday, you came home Thursday night, and you did that for 4 weeks. But you were with people that did that for 6 years, right? So it's 2 a.m, like my third or fourth call night on trauma, and my third year resident announces that it's time to take this burn, this gentleman with a like 90% body surface area burn, to the operating room, and we're going to have to do the burn dressings. And that means the OR is going to be set to body temperature. You're going to be sweating your lady balls off in this gown for hours while we soak off his dressings. We put on new dressings, and it's the middle of the night, and you're so tired that it hurts. And I just was like, oh my God, no, I can't believe, you know, kind of like you're doing this to us. And he just looked at me and he kind of just let out this little sigh. And he said, don't you know how much harder it is for me when you approach it with that attitude? Because again, he's somebody that's doing that for 6 years. This is my fourth call ever. And I really learned from that. And he didn't yell at me. He wasn't mean. He was nice to me the rest of the rotation. But I was like, oh my God, I have an influence on the environment. My attitude actually affects this learning environment. And not only that, it affects me. That didn't help me to do that. I could say, you know, wow, this poor human's 90% burned. Yeah, let's go take care of him. And that is just a healthier way, you know, to approach it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when we think about paths forward, I feel like that is something that all of us could model a little bit better. It's sort of baked into the joy, and you have to be authentic about it. Like, sometimes it's okay to just like say you don't want to do something and laugh about it. I think that's important too. I mean, I really think humor makes a huge difference in our environments, but I think a lot of us worry that humor now is not well received. So we have to be very careful sometimes, because I think a lot of us worry about offending people. I want to go back to the email. That is how I found you in the first place. There is a quote which I can read because it gets at this theme, which is necessary discomfort versus unnecessary pain. So I'm going to read to you what you wrote. We need to be much more okay with being the source of the discomfort. We need to stop fixing their discomfort for them. We need to be much more okay with them struggling and blaming us for how they feel, and supporting each other as educators, so we are not made to feel like we are bad parents for not fixing their feelings or sentiments on surveys. Good parents allow their children to struggle at the developmental level that is appropriate for them, and good teachers do the same for their pupils. That is what we need to provide. We need to be the collective adversity, at times, that they form community around, and we need to know that means we are doing a good job, and that is not a problem to be fixed. So what prompted you to write that?
I think probably my own sadness at feeling like I had left something that I loved and that was important to me, because I could not figure out a way to conquer that problem. I could not somehow overcome, whether it was institutional or at the national level or at the accreditation level, this constant pressure to provide students with satisfaction, and how often as an educator that felt like it was in direct conflict with providing them with the quality of education and the rigor of training that's really needed to do a good job.
What finally tipped you over? What made you leave? When did you leave? And can you talk about that experience?
Well, and I want to be clear that this wasn't the only factor in me deciding to change my career. I had, like I said, gotten two teenagers through COVID, with including, you know, grappling with some significant mental illness, mental adversity with that. I had a husband who had life-threatening cancer, extremely serious treatment, and who was and remains ill as a result of that, also at the same time. And I was trying to, you know, run a med school from my basement with a great team, but we were all in our basements and we were all struggling. My struggles aren't unique. There are people with young kids. I don't know how they made it when daycare is closed and how you're supposed to work. My struggle is not unique. Everybody struggled. But I came to a place in my life where I knew that I had done all I could, that it seemed like I was different, meaning what I was willing to do, put up with, withstand, fight for, was different. I had done what I could, where the students were different, meaning that the things that I felt like I was doing to demonstrate love, caring, concern, and appropriate discipline just weren't, it either wasn't working or it wasn't being received in the spirit that I was giving it. And so it felt like, well, maybe they need something different. You know, if this is what I have to give and it's not working for them, maybe they need something different too. And I needed a job where I could go to work, see my patients, do a great job, hand off my patients, and then come home and be present for my family at home and present for myself in a different way. I needed to be in a different phase of life. And so this is one factor, but I don't want anybody that hears this to think like, oh, she's mad at the students and that's why she left, because that's truly not it. I have the same love for medical students that I've always had. But I think that the way things changed demonstrated that my core values, beliefs, and modus operandi were no longer going to be what fit the expectation of leadership, what fit the expectation of accreditation, what fit the expectation of students. It's just that I'm not convinced that my way of being, my modus operandi, is necessarily wrong. And I say that because I'm a super happy clinical doctor who knows a lot of things and who feels great about the care that I give. And I'm very happy in my work. And I just wish that more medical educators were able to get students there. And I'm worried about that.
Can you talk about the response to your email and contrast the response that gets shared publicly versus the comments that you get privately?
I've gotten a lot of private kind of attaboy or yes, I agree so much kind of responses. There were a couple people who were brave and shared publicly that they agreed, which I appreciated. And then I think there were a couple folks who were worried that my response meant that I didn't care about burnout or worry about student well-being. Again, I feel like that's a false dichotomy. Me saying that we have to provide a framework for some healthy struggle and support doesn't mean that I don't think wellness is important or that I don't care about students, but I think that's what always gets brought up. So again, going back to we need the right treatment for the right problem. If making things easier was going to fix the problem of student wellness and student burnout, we would be seeing improvements. What we see instead and talk about behind closed doors as educators is each change we try to make to, I'll use the short term, make their lives easier, make things better, seems to make them less well, more helpless, less able, less capable, less confident in their own abilities, more broken. And so if this was going to work, if this was the right path, why aren't we seeing anything get better? We need something different.
Yeah, I think there's just a massive conflation with this idea of ease and well-being. And it is having a paradoxical effect in that it's decreasing people's well-being. And it's also not preparing us to be good doctors, which in itself doesn't feel good at all. And obviously it has a much greater impact on society both now and in the future. So I think that's such an important point. And I think that you bring up one of these core anxieties, which is that to offer up any perspective that could be perceived as not caring about well-being is anxiety inducing for a lot of people, which is why we're only willing to talk about this behind closed doors. I think a related problem, which I personally worry about so much, is that when you bring this up, somebody inevitably says, oh, you don't care about training mental health, or you don't care about the high suicide rates in the profession, which is even more damning. Like you don't want to be the person that's essentially saying, no, I don't care about training depression. And so I'm wondering, when you think about the work environments and loving your students and teaching them joy, how you separate paying attention to real mental illness and this pursuit of well-being?
Well, I think, you know, one thing, when I used to be one of the people talking to students about self-care and wellness, I would make a clear delineation between what I would call pleasurable pursuits or bathrobe time and actual self-care, because self-care is a lot more like things you don't want to do that you know are good for you. How do you know it's self-care? It's the same feeling you get when you're like, I should go to the gym. I should take a walk outside. I should eat that apple instead of those chocolate covered pretzels. I should, right? So, you know, and any one of us could make a list of 10 activities. They tend to be activities that when we're finished with them, we feel more whole, more well, more energized, more positive, more capable, more happy, more able to give and receive love, right? We can each make a list of those 10 activities. But most of them aren't things that feel great in the first 10 minutes while you're doing them, right? It's not taking a bath with bubbles. It's not, the chocolate covered pretzels are really good. Like, I'm going to keep coming back to them. If you haven't gotten them from Costco, do, or maybe don't. I mean, it's up to you. But it's going to be things that are more work than that. Therapy is work. And so what I would encourage people to do is talk to their wellness deans and their student affairs deans, because there's a lot of frustration there that we're offering a lot of wellness programming. We're putting a lot of financial and people resources into it, and students aren't coming. Now, sometimes you're really tired and you need a nap, and you can't take naps at work. I've tried. It's really frowned upon, right? So if you're really, truly exhausted, or you have mono, or your mom got in an accident, or there's something, yeah, you shouldn't go be on clerkships. Yes, you should have an excused absence. But what I want people to understand about modern medical education is it's not the medical education they went through. Those policies are in place. Students are already getting excused absences all over the place for any of the stuff that you and I would have thought like we would have worried about missing work for. No, they're getting those absences. There's no problem. There's no problem if you need to go to a doctor's appointment or something. A wellness day is that, which was the initial thing that was brought up in the conversation, is like in addition. It's like a what they would call a personal day or something. You know, it's not for a doctor's appointment. It's not because you had a flat tire. It's not because you're sick. It's not because your mom or your sibling is depressed and is getting admitted to an outside unit and you have to be there for them. It's like a bathrobe day, you know, and it's not going to make you any better unless you're doing something a little more active with that.
I asked Amy at the end whether there were any final words she wanted to share.
I think the only things that I would add is, it shouldn't take somebody leaving their job and no longer having to fear consequences to talk about this. And that it's very telling that nobody's willing to talk about it on the record, because what that tells you is that's part of the brokenness of our system, and that no medical education professional should have to feel afraid of talking about these things, these challenges that we all share. And again, that just, we all love our students, all of us.
I'm super grateful to Amy for having the courage to talk about some of these challenges. I know it's not easy. I'd also like to thank our editor, Deborah Molina, and our senior producer, Mary Rose Madden, music by Blue Dot Sessions. Next up on Not Otherwise Specified, we're going to delve into training unions, another topic that's been a bit charged. We'll talk a bit about the pros, the cons, and the reasons we're seeing such an uptick in training unionization.
Medical residents feel overworked, we feel underpaid, we feel that we're not receiving the value for the work that we're putting into the institutions and the huge sacrifices that we make to get to the places that we are. And my worry is that it's keeping people away from medicine, and that we're starting to see a shift nationally where our profession is losing ground. And it's starting from the bottom with trainees.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. This is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Thanks for listening. Until next week.